Welcome to the University of Melbourne and to the Centre for Advanced Journalism. My name is Margaret Simons. I'm the Director of the Centre, and this is our first major public event for the year. Our speaker tonight is Professor Julian Disney. I'll give him a fuller introduction in a moment. But perhaps, first of all, I can just set some context for this address. I'd like to take you back to October 2009, when Professor Disney's predecessor, Ken McKinnon, used his last annual report as chair of the Australian Press Council to call for a review of the accountability of newspaper editors. And he fired a parting shot at the industry, accusing it of undermining the Press Council's role and independence. He flayed the industry for what he said was a failure to live up to its own rhetoric on ethics, privacy and independence. And he gave as examples the famous Utegate scandal involving Godwin Gretsch and the publication of photos supposedly of Pauline Hanson as examples of the media failing to observe its own standards. He sledged so-called reform proposals urged by newspaper publishers that resulted in a reduction in the Press Council's membership and activities. And the result, he said, had been a downgrading and perhaps even an elimination of the Council's role in defending press freedom. Now, our speaker tonight is a brave man, and the reason I say that is probably fairly apparent when I say that just a few weeks after that sledging from the former chair of the Press Council, it was announced that Julian Disney would be the next chair. This was the environment he came into. Since then, he's led a reform movement in consultation with the nation's largest publishers, which over that time has seen funding restored, standards reviewed and renewed, better procedures, and a raise in the Council's profile, which has led to a doubling in the number of complaints it's receiving from the public. But of course, nothing stands still in the world of media. At the same time, we've had the News of the World scandal in the United Kingdom, which has meant that media standards and journalism ethics have been a front-of-mind issue around the world, and particularly perhaps in Australia. And for this and other political reasons, we've had our own Finkelstein inquiry, which has recommended that the Australian Press Council be abolished, to be replaced with a government-funded statutory body, the News Media Council, with power to force the publication of corrections, apologies, and rights of reply. These recommendations have been vehemently opposed by all the mainstream media organisations. Meanwhile, Julian Disney has urged the publishers to improve the funding and powers of the Australian Press Council if they want to avoid the Finkelstein regime. Julian Disney is a part-time professor and director of the Social Justice Project at the University of New South Wales. He has previously been Professor of Public Law at the Australian National University and Director of its Centre for International and Public Law. He is also a visiting professor at the University of Technology, Sydney. Indeed, his list of roles in public advocacy, policy development, law reform, and as an advisor to governments is far too long to be encapsulated here. He's a man with a lot of experience in public life, and given this history and his present position, you can see why I call him courageous. His work was clearly influential on Ray Finkelstein, and he is now at the centre of the debate about journalism standards in the wake of the Finkelstein report. This is his first major address since the Finkelstein report was released. I'll ask you to join me in welcoming Professor Julian Disney.
Thanks very much, Margaret, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm sometimes melancholic when I come past this building because, as you may be aware, this is where the stonemasons, or just out that way, stonemasons downed their tools in the 1850s and marched into Melbourne in search of an eight-hour day. And it's a long time since I had an eight-hour day. I was thinking that perhaps we might all disband this evening and march on Melbourne, but then I thought our credibility would be limited in that I've volunteered to speak. I've already done 8 hours today, and you've volunteered to listen, and I'll bet you've done 8 hours, so we probably haven't got much credibility in complaining. Margaret asked me to speak, or we sort of agreed on the topic of why good journalism will always matter. I've dealt with journalists a lot over the last 30-odd years, and I know enough about them to know that the best thing to do is touch briefly on the topic that they've raised and then move on to what you wanted to say anyway. And I'll comply with that tonight, but I think probably what I'm going to say is what Margaret had in mind in any event. So I'm going to say a little bit about good journalism and journalism, but then I'll focus on media standards, particularly in the context of the debate that's occurring here in Australia and in the UK, and I might add also in New Zealand. I think there's some very important work being done on options for media regulation in New Zealand. I'm not, and this isn't attempting to abandon the category of media academics, who of course are a little bit beleaguered at the moment, but I do need to emphasise I'm not a media academic and therefore I'm not speaking from a theoretical point of view at all. More really from a practical point of view in two senses. One is I have been for some decades particularly active in public advocacy in various areas and often also in leading coalitions of business and community groups, which is a little similar to what the Press Council is. And so I'm drawing really on that practical experience of engaging with the media from that point of view. And I think that that side of the media experience does need to be heard more by the media practitioners themselves. But I'm also drawing now on 2 years, not huge time, but 2 years of experience as chairing the council. I agreed to chair the council because it was weak. I find it a bit odd when people say, and they've said it to me on a couple of times in my life, why are you working so hard on that body? It's so weak, it's a waste of time. Well, I don't think that's the first question you should ask. The first question you should ask is, does this body have an important role to play? Is there a better body around that can play that role or is playing that role? Or is this the best hope? And if that's the case, then the fact that it's weak at the time is in fact an argument for engaging with it, not an argument for regarding it as beyond redemption. So I took some time when I was approached about chairing the council before I decided to do it. But it was to a considerable extent because I thought it was the best hope of the side and it, for a variety of reasons, hadn't been able to be effective and that we needed to try and help it be effective. So I'll turn first then to very briefly what is good journalism, but I'm not going to really attempt to be particularly profound or original. There are others who are much better able to say that or to meet those requirements than I am. But I'll just say a few things about, firstly, what I would see as the basic requirements of good journalism, and to some extent these are based on the council standards. But there's quite a striking similarity, in fact, between our standards and the standards as espoused in newspaper codes. And I've just been looking this morning when I met with 9MSN, who have indicated a desire to join the council. I've been looking at their code. And they have the same three words at the core of their code as we have at the core of ours. And those words are accuracy, fairness, and balance. Accuracy, we actually focus particularly on reasonable attempts to be accurate. That's really the top priority. And if those attempts fail and one is inaccurate, then one must very promptly correct the inaccuracy. Fairness is a somewhat more amorphous concept, but it includes, for example, not distorting what one's reporting about or what one's expressing opinions about. Not causing offence, but I do think this is an example of where our principles and the principles of many of the newspapers themselves need further thought. I'm not keen on principles which are too strict or too utopian and therefore are not applied. And I think that applies to some of our principles, and I think it quite often applies actually to statements within newspaper codes. We don't require, and we shouldn't require, I think, that every article is balanced in itself. And yet, reading our principles, you might think we do. And reading newspapers' codes, you might think they do. So I think we need to tease out that a little bit more in some of our work. We also don't require, and I don't think we should require, that a newspaper be immaculately balanced in its coverage over time. It's a question of degree. And I think we don't indicate that clearly enough in our principles. So balance, for those reasons amongst others, is a complex concept, and it's certainly not, and I know this is a controversial area to which there's no easy answer, but balance doesn't mean having to represent all views, and it doesn't mean giving equal weight to all views. I do have some concern, not so much in the newspapers actually, but I'd have to say my concern probably relates more to the ABC, and I can speak with Gay Abandon about them since we don't have any responsibility for them at all. But I do think it's a great mistake, and that it's damaging actually to public policy and to public life and public discussion to think that the best way to provide balance is to put two extreme views up against each other. This is what I call the crossfire approach, if any of you have seen Crossfire in the United States, which thrives on extremist adversarial debate. I think is damaging. It's driving moderates to some extent out of public debate, and I think that's very unfortunate. So balance isn't met just by putting two extremes up against each other, nor is it met just by providing equal time for all views. I don't pretend there's an easy answer to what it is, but I'm just trying to say some things about what I don't think it is. There's also an area of our standards which probably, generically speaking, one could talk about as a sense of respect or civility. So this includes, for example, protecting privacy, though perhaps we need to be a bit more specific about what we mean by that. And we also have a word that does worry me to some extent, which is not upsetting people's sensibilities. I think that's too strict a standard, not too sure what it means, but if newspapers really weren't able to upset people's sensibilities, we'd lose a hell of a lot. So, and yet again, you'll see those terms in newspapers' codes themselves. So I think we need to try and get the wording more accurate, get the standards more accurate, and then apply them. Not have them as utopian and extreme, and then say, well, of course, we can't possibly apply that. But obviously, those are the things that I feel, anyway, are the sort of basic requirements of good journalism. That's focusing more on content, but there are also questions, of course, about how you've gathered the information. That touches on things like the use of dishonest or unfair means. Now, we don't, and I don't think we should, totally preclude the use of dishonest or unfair means. We do say that it can be legitimate if it's in the public interest. Now, I think we need to say a little bit more about the strength of public interest that's required, that it needs to be very clear and it needs to be major in order to justify the use of dishonest or unfair means. But we don't preclude them, and I don't think we should. Though there may be scope for us to do more work in the area of harassment. Our counterpart in the United Kingdom is very active in relation to, and probably more successful and quite well regarded by the media, in relation to things like trying to stop harassment of people by print journalists, and also, of course, it flows over into the broadcast media. And that's something I hope that we'll be able to combine with ACMA, which regulates broadcast journalism, to try to move fairly quickly in some of the areas. We had it in Sydney recently with the so-called collarbomb incident, where there was harassment for much too long of the schoolgirl involved, quite unjustifiable, and we're going to need to get our act together in the future to deal with that more. Now, I think probably much of that was to do more with the electronic media than the print media, but certainly some print media was involved. And when I spoke to one of them as to why his reporters were out here, he said, because the opposition's reporters were out there. If I'd asked the opposition, they would probably have said the same thing. And so we need to try and do something in that area. But of course, in addition to those basic requirements, there are things that are more positive, like knowledge and perception, originality, persistence, courage. I'm quite frequently struck by and grateful for the courage. I don't just mean physical courage. I mean at least as much courage in facing entrenched interests that journalists provide. Very often one does say thank God for the contribution that they've made in exposing things. Now, sometimes the downside for that, often to stand up against vested interests, to be confident enough of one's own opinion to challenge those vested interests, can come from a personality which is pretty self-confident and pretty aggressive. We get some value from that because it does mean that we get strong vested interests exposed that we otherwise wouldn't get. It can sometimes flow over, I think, into less desirable elements and perspectives in the media of excessive aggression and excessive self-confidence. And also, of course, sometimes they need just some basic cunning to thwart those who don't want to tell them the truth. I think it's important to emphasise, though, that good journalism, I think, matters more than ever. That's partly because, from a positive point of view, there are now so many benefits that can be obtained from new technologies and brought to us through good journalism. In other words, the sort of palette that's available to journalists now is so much richer because of the internet. That means those who can master these new skills and opportunities can really make a very great contribution to us. And you see this in some newspapers and others abroad, it's starting to develop here. So that's one reason why it matters more than ever, that I think the opportunities and the potential benefits of damn good journalism are greater. It's also that, related to that, is that the bar is being raised in various ways. The extent to which now journalists, I hope not all, and I'll come back to why, but journalists need to have a wider range of skills, need to be able to think more about putting links into their articles, about bringing in more graphics than they were able to before because of the opportunities that online provides. So even just for competitive reasons, good journalism is going to matter more than ever. Just to digress as to why I hope not everyone will be required to do that, one thing that has struck me from when I first started engaging with journalists a long time ago was how people who, from the way in which they wrote, you would imagine to be extremely articulate and fluent and confident orally, when I met them, were often not at all. And you could realise why, for some of them, why they'd become journalists. They weren't comfortable orally, they often weren't comfortable in society. But they had a lot to offer, and they found it easiest to do that in writing. And I hope we won't lose them. I hope we won't lose them because they can't front up to do the quick video link. They don't feel they've got the personality, the way of thinking, or perhaps their bosses don't think they have the personality or way of thinking that will handle that element of journalism. It's important that we still keep a place for those people who don't have those characteristics but have a huge amount to offer through their capacities for thought and their capacities for written expression. I think it also matters more than ever because the sifting, which is really one of the key roles of journalism in my view, not all journalism of course, but a very important part of it, the sifting of material is now likely to be very much harder in many areas, partly just because of the enormous increase in the volume of material to sift, again partly because of the internet, partly because of globalisation in any event, even if there wasn't the internet. And related to that, not only a greater volume, but a greater diversity of sources and a greater likelihood that some of the sources are not well known to the reporter, which makes it harder to sift them for reliability. So that's an increased challenge. And another challenge which is of huge importance, and is probably my main reason for why I think good journalism is more important than ever, is that errors now, if made, are more widespread, by and large, because of the internet. So they go out to a wider range of people. They can be passed on before there's much opportunity to correct them at all, whether by the reporter doing it or by other people expressing opinions. It's a huge mistake to say, as I heard one very senior executive say to me very early in my time as chair of the council, we can put it up and we can change it later. That's a huge mistake, to just rely on that view. With a lot of this stuff, you can't change it later. Well, you can change it later, but the old stuff will still be there and going around and around like space junk in perpetuity. We really can't accept the view that you can rush something out to beat the opposition and tidy it up later. And that's a great challenge and another reason why I think good journalism is more important than ever. And of course, speed, the rush to judgment, does create greater risks. We need to be careful, I think, of complacency, of saying, for example, that the problems in the United Kingdom were heavily driven by the competition between the red tops, between the tabloids. That is certainly true, and we don't have that here. But here and in other parts of the world, some of the elements, the detrimental impacts of competition, are emerging from the internet, the pressure to rush to judgment, to beat the others by a nanosecond. The pressure also to be more flamboyant and simplistic. Those are some of the negative sides that we need to be careful of and could induce elements of the undesirable aspects of competition that we saw leading to problems in the United Kingdom. So complacency, I think, is we should be very wary of, and I think some say that we shouldn't be paying attention to the debate in the United Kingdom about media regulation. I totally disagree with that. I think it's actually much more sophisticated and thoughtful, and that the media is engaging it in a much more open way than most, not all, most of their counterparts here in Australia. Now, it may be that they're doing that because they've been blasted out of complacency, and it may be that that blast won't happen here, but the degree of, I think, recognition that a simplistic rebuttal of views from an extreme perspective is not sufficient. I think that's been realised more in the United Kingdom, and there are a lot of positive proposals, detailed proposals being put by leading editors in the United Kingdom that we're tending not to get as much of in Australia, but with some striking exceptions here. There are two or three, I think, who are doing a great job, and I hope there'll be more. Well, can I move on then to some comments about media standards in Australia, and then I... before that, I'll just, having said something about what is good journalism, I just want to, without attempting to answer the question hugely, say, well, that raises the question, what's a journalist? Who's a journalist? Now, it's probably agreed, I won't go into the sort of detail that the media academics will on this, but I think, broadly speaking, the base role is gathering or analysing or presenting information or opinion. But, of course, the advent of the internet has really... destroyed to some extent the neat clarity of the definition, or at least of its practical clarity. It was fairly easy until perhaps 10 years ago to say that person's a journalist and that one isn't. It was mainly based, I think, whether rationally or not, on whether it was their main occupation or not. But now, of course, we have so many people for whom that role that I've spoken about is not their main occupation, but who do have, amongst other things, widespread exposure for what they're saying. Some people call the distinction, they say all these folk are journalists, so they'd include bloggers. They say all these folk are journalists, and the distinction is between perhaps professional journalists and something like citizen journalists or public journalists. So that says everyone's a journalist, but it still has, there tends to be an acceptance that there's some degree of distinction within that broad category. Others don't regard it as a distinction within a category, but as two different categories. So there's a journalist and then there's the great unwashed, the news gatherers, some call them, or sources or whatever. We are going to have to face this question, at least for some purposes, not necessarily in terms of what the definition of journalism is, but in terms of who is going to get the array of privileges that have been provided over time to journalists and were provided to them at a time when there was not much doubt in people's minds, both the recipients' minds and the people who were granting the privileges, there was not much doubt as to who qualified as journalist. But there's much more doubt now, and that will grow. And if we don't clarify this to some extent, one of the problems will be that I think there'll be a reluctance to provide or to maintain those privileges if there's great uncertainty as to who it is that one's giving the privileges to. Now, these privileges may relate to content, for example. There are privileges that relate to people who are called journalists or media organisations or whatever, to do with privacy, to do with defamation, to do with the provision of financial advice, and in various other areas. The Finkelstein report has a very good summary of these, as does the New Zealand Law Commission report that I've referred to indirectly before. Those are privileges in relation to content. There are privileges in relation to access, access to courts, access to governments, such as and access to parliament. There's also, and I think Margaret Simons has referred to this and others have, there's actually just the sort of inestimable privilege of being able to call someone up on the phone and say you're a journalist, and they'll answer questions they'd never dream of answering to other people who they would dismiss rapidly as nosy and impertinent. So we are going to have to think through this some more, and particularly as convergence further progresses, as to who is going to have these privileges. That may be partly for the reason that the New Zealand Law Commission has put, which is usually in life we regard privileges as carrying corresponding obligations. So that's one reason that we may need to think it through. But the other is, as I say, that these privileges may not be maintained or may not be granted if governments or others who are giving them don't feel they know who they're being given to. That's a reason, for example, why the Shield laws that... enable journalists not to disclose the identity of whistleblowers. The state governments so far have refused to extend them beyond a narrow definition of journalists because they don't have an alternative definition of journalists that they're confident excludes people who they would regard as likely to be irresponsible. So there needs to be some thinking about that. Now, what we tend to do in other professions and occupations is we often, if we're defining a category that we're going to give special privileges, whether it's doctors or lawyers or whatever, we look at their role, but we don't just look at their role. We look at their training, and we may have requirements in relation to training and accreditation. And we look at the extent to which they're subject to a centralised and respected system of standards and complaints handling. So if you look at how we do it in other walks of life, that's how we do it. Now, that doesn't mean we need to do it exactly the same way here. There are different considerations in relation to the media, not always as different, I think, as some in the media believe, but I accept that there are some differences. For example, I'm certainly not at all keen on a sort of credentialised approach to coming into journalism with people having to have done a doctorate or something before they can write 100 words. So I'm not arguing for that particularly. But the question of a complaints and standards system, I just point out, has been regarded as a pretty crucial part of identification of other people to whom privileges are given. Okay, let me move on then to media standards and just some comments about them, inevitably pretty much of a broad overview, and then I want to get to the question of regulation and the issues of that are right in front of us at the moment. In talking about media standards, I'm going to focus mainly on print and online. And really, much of the material that I think one needs to look at and think about in this is in the Finkelstein report. I think there's a very good coverage of the surveys that have been done in relation to levels of public trust and public confidence, etc. I think it's not true, incidentally, to assert, as some have, that those surveys are a test of popularity. They're not a test of popularity. They were carefully designed, and or the particular one that's often quoted, the Australian Election Survey study. It was to do with trust and public confidence, and it came up with a very low figure for print media. And one can't just say, well, that's the name of the game in media, because some media, and the ABC stood out, some media did a hell of a lot better. So we do need to think about that. That's a warning sign. And even if one's just concerned about market forces and declining circulation, that's a worry. And I think one of the roles the council has is in its modest way to try and help lift these figures up to more respectable figures of trust and public confidence. But we also have the concerns that have been expressed over the years by many widely respected citizens and journalists, sometimes publicly, sometimes not. I've just spoken in the last month or so to probably six or seven of the most widely respected, 10 most widely respected journalists in Australia, spoken to them individually. All of them very worried about some aspects of media standards. Now, that's not surprising. This is not that the media is worse than anyone else, it's just that it's not better either. Any walk of life, there will be scope for substantial improvement. Each of us probably could substantially improve whatever we're doing and would probably benefit from hearing the views of people who are not too close to us and not too much with the same vested interests as we have. So this isn't particularly wanting to single out the media area, but just to say there's not the slightest justification for complacency. Too many sensible and widely respected people have pointed out problems, and as I say, many of them have been journalists themselves, just in terms of people who've been on the public record recently. You'll see Laurie Oakes and Barry Cassidy are just two. We've also conducted what I hope we'll be able to do much more of, which is community roundtables. In four states. In the morning we met with about 20 journalists, and in the afternoon we met with about 20 community leaders from very wide range, business, environment, welfare, local council, union, etc. A striking feature of that, incidentally, was how many of the community leaders said, and I'm afraid it came as no surprise to me because I've been in that role myself, that they would not speak out publicly about problems with the media because they feared that it would adversely affect the coverage they get in future. And that is a problem if that's the situation. It means we're not hearing enough of their concerns from serious citizens. They also don't have much contact with editors. I've spoken to editors about this and I've been very pleased that they've responded favourably to the idea that I might try to bring together an editor with a few community leaders, just three or four people meeting informally to discuss issues. The community leaders, by and large, except perhaps in the business community, tend to have very little contact with the editors themselves. I, when I was leading community groups, met frequently with prime ministers and treasurers and senior ministers. I never met with an editor in that whole time. I spoke recently to the head of, probably the longest serving head of a national NGO in Australia. He said he had never in his 12 or 13 years at the helm met an editor. And yet editors are and should be very influential on what is in their newspapers. We need to try to break down that divide. And the divide is getting worse in a way because editors now, under the new 24-hour news cycle, have to spend so much time minding the shop. There's not just one deadline a day. So I think that, and it would also bring home to the community leaders who you know, are no more necessarily inherently fair and rational than the media people I'm speaking about, to bring across to them more of the other side of the picture and the other perspectives. It's not sufficient, I think, as I've seen too many journalists do, to say, well, when there's criticism, to say, well, we're not perfect, and then move on without indicating anything about what they think are the imperfections, or to say, well, there are some problems, but then never indicate what they are or what might be done about them. Or, and this is a strategy I saw just a couple of days ago, to hugely exaggerate the criticism that's being made, to say, well, you know, not all journalists are waiting to hack phones. Well, of course they're not, no one's suggesting that. But that sort of exaggeration of the argument, the straw man approach, has been resorted to too often, in public. In private, I know because I've, as I say, known a lot of journalists well, personal friends for a long time. It's a much more constructive and realistic approach, and we need to somehow try and build on that. I think that's a role that we can play at the council, not necessarily leading to any standards that we develop, certainly not leading to complaints, but just leading to try and get key players together to try to think about how they and their organisations can improve their performance. Well, I want to move on then to the last part of what I was going to say, which is to do with what people often call regulation, so I'll use that term. Although I don't really see the Press Council as a regulator, I haven't been able to come up with a better term. We're not just an ombudsman either, but I don't really see us as a full-blown regulator, nor that we should be. But we do have an influence on standards and should have a greater influence than we've had to date. The background to what I'm going to say is that really convergence between broadcast media, other new technologies, and print is really going to be, I think, the driving force in terms of changing regulatory systems. There's been too much focus, I think, by opponents of some of the changes that are being proposed on what Mr. Finkelstein may have said, or on the iniquities of the Gillard government, or the undesirability of the Senator Brown having persuaded that government to set up the inquiry. That's a very short-term, limited focus. These issues were going to come up anyway as to what regulatory system we're going to need in the future. And the council developed our views, which we've stayed with ever since, before Finkelstein had even been set up. Because we're going to get eventually the need to come together in one regulatory system. I'll say a little bit more about some refinements of that in a minute. But we are going to have to come together in one regulatory system. And we're going to, in a sense, have a choice. We're going to have a choice between what currently happens in the broadcast area, which is a statutory authority with substantial statutory powers. The members of the authority appointed by government, fully funded by government, etc. That model. And at the other end, towards the other end of the spectrum, some form of council which doesn't have those key characteristics that I mentioned. Now, the Press Council in the past, in my view, has been down an unacceptably far down the other end of the spectrum, too weak and ineffective. But we need to develop an independent council as a model, as an alternative to the statutory model, so that when the time comes and a choice will have to be made, which it will, whatever one may think about Finkelstein or about Bob Brown or anything, this choice is going to have to be made. I don't know exactly when, but in five or 10 years, we will have to converge more in these regulatory systems. And our goal at the Press Council is to develop a strong model of an independent council which is available to be chosen, hopefully, at the time when that choice has to be made, because we don't like the statutory authority model of the ACMA. Now, that's for different reasons for different members of the council. Some don't like bodies that are fully or substantially government-funded. Others don't like them if they are that and government appointed. Others believe that statutory authorities, especially if they're subject to the very detailed rules of statutory decision making, are inevitably too legalistic, slow, possibly adversarial, and that means that a large number of the mainstream of the community won't really be able to take advantage of them. And that's certainly central to my own concerns about a large bureaucracy playing this role. I just don't think it will be effectively available to, frankly, the people in the community who most need it, because they don't have much influence to get their own way anyway. I was involved with a complaint recently where, without being very specific, the complainant had the assistance, because of a close relationship, of one of our four or five wealthiest people in Australia. Now, that complainant came to us and we rang the newspaper in question, but we weren't needed. The wealthy person had already rung the newspaper and the matter had been solved very quickly. We weren't needed. But we are needed in other cases where you haven't got those sorts of friends to exert some pressure. So we believe that there should be a two-phase approach to this. Firstly, to strengthen the Press Council in the way that I've foreshadowed, but I'll mention some key elements, so that we do have a strong independent council as a choice when the time comes. Some elements of that then. Firstly, the ambit of it. We do think it should be print and online. That's a huge challenge, just to work with print and online, and perhaps in questions some more issues about online can be dealt with. But I'm very pleased that Crikey has indicated that they will join us, and 9MSN has also indicated that they would like to join us, and we have several other online-only publishers, smallish ones, but they're the ones who've approached us. We actually haven't approached anyone except Crikey so far. The others have come to us. But it is very important that print and online go forward together. It's quite irrational to have them separate, confusing and inefficient when there's so much overlap with so many things appearing on both media, or very similar things appearing on both media. So print and online first. To bring broadcasting in is a massive task, extremely hard to work through, and I think for that, amongst other reasons, needs to be left until later. We do need, though, the Press Council to have legally binding obligations now from the publishers. These must be firmly legally binding, contractual preferably. We don't favour them being statutory. That would certainly be a last resort. But if we can get them as contractually binding obligations, that's good, and that's the approach being pursued in the United Kingdom by our counterpart. In relation to sanctions, I'm personally, at least for the foreseeable future, feel we need to focus more on the sanctions we've got. Contrary to what some people say, there is a requirement to publish all our adjudications, and they are all published. They're not always published with sufficient prominence. In fact, I'd say, could almost say most of them are not published with sufficient prominence. And we will take a very firm line on that. There's already an obligation to do that, and it needs to be a contractual obligation, and it needs to be complied with. So that not only so that the complainant is done justice, but also that the public sees what the council does. One of the problems of the obscurity of the adjudications is that most people don't see what we do enough. That's aggravated hugely, though, by the fact that most of our work doesn't go to formal adjudications anyway. Of the complaints that come to us, only about 10% proceed through to an adjudication that appears in a newspaper. The other 90% are either resolved to the satisfaction of the complainant or the complainant gives up, not always satisfied. But many of them, at least half, I'd say, it's the sort of thing it's pretty hard to measure with precision, are ones where there is a satisfactory resolution. But you would never hear about it. You would never know that it happened. The only people who know about it are the newspaper and the complainant in question. So most of our successes are completely unknown to the public. I'll just give you a small example that happened recently when Bernard Tomic had his driving licence displayed on the website of a newspaper with all the details available. Now, that was fixed up in a couple of hours with the council calling the newspaper in question. And that's quite a common outcome, but no one would know that. We need to get that acknowledged more so that people know that it's worth complaining to us. We will move more. We've agreed that we will censure newspapers where we think it's appropriate, that we'll call for apologies and corrections, but we won't direct them. We're not seeking the power to direct those apologies and corrections. If we don't get the degree of compliance we need over time, well, we may or others may have to think about something firmer. But I think we've got more than enough, frankly, to utilise the powers that we've got now to get them made legally binding and to utilise them properly. That's more than enough to keep us busy. We need proper funding. Our resources have been hopelessly inadequate. 3.5 staff now, will be 4.5 soon. That's really derisory. And we've pushed for 8, not exactly contrary to one of our publisher members who said it was a cast of thousands. He may have missed mathematics class, I'm not sure, but, 8. But that's $2 million, which is dollars, which is double what we've been getting. And I'm hopeful that the publishers will come to the party, because that's not an Ambit claim. That's a very modest and realistic claim for us, just to be able to fulfil our basic responsibilities to the publishers who set us up, and to the public who, in a sense, are relying on this to work rather than to push for something more extreme. That money needs to be secure. It is a spectre hanging over both my two immediate predecessors and myself. I'm quite open about the fact that the risk of publishers withdrawing funding in their membership is a spectre that hangs over us. Of course, we do our best to resist it, but it's a spectre, and it's not a good spectre. We need to get rid of it. We need to have security of membership and funding from the publishers, and that's a very strong view held also in the UK and New Zealand, and agreed with, I think, by a number of publishers. And we also need, of course, our funding to at least provide some confidence that we're reasonably independent. If the publishers' money, if we're fully funded by the publishers, but the publishers can't withdraw that money, that significantly reduces the problems of lack of independence that one might think are pretty blindingly obvious if you're totally funded by the publishers. So if we can get that security, that fairly significantly addresses the independence problem. But we do also, and we've had agreement in the past, to get at least some money, project funding money, from other sources, and that could include government. But that's project money, not core funding. And the key goal of all this is, I think, very well expressed by the media minister in the United Kingdom, the Conservative Party minister who's responsible for the media there, who says that what he's looking for in the reform there is a regulatory system which is independent of government and sufficiently independent of publishers to command public confidence. And to me, that's a one-liner for what we've got to achieve. And I believe very firmly that we must make very substantial progress towards that, demonstrable progress, accepted progress, and substantial progress over the next 3 years. There is too much understandable scepticism about repeated assurances that we'll lift our game, or they'll lift our game, the publishers will support this sort of operation. That, I think, is understandably met with by considerable cynicism and scepticism. And that's why I'm quite clearly putting on the council and on myself a 3-year on-notice period. We've got to very substantially improve our performance and very substantially indicate that we can command public confidence in 3 years. We'll need the publisher's support to do that. I'll just mention a couple of other things that I think are important in how we go forward. We need to, you may have seen, I hope an increasing number will have seen now, that newspapers, most of the newspapers now, have our logo in them every day, indicating how to contact us and indicating also that they are bound by our standards of practice. That's a good step forward. It may have been one of the factors that contributed to the doubling of complaints that Margaret referred to. We need to be much quicker than we have been, although we're not as slow as some have suggested. I think perhaps the Finkelstein report, that's one area where I'd say it probably was a little astray in exaggerating the extent to which we're slow, but we're not quick enough, and we need to do that. And we need to be rigorous and vigorous. The uphold rate for our complaints increased from just over 40% to 70% in the last year. Now, we don't set a target for how many we uphold. That would be quite wrong. But we did set a target of being more rigorous, and that's the consequence. If it drops to 50% this year, that won't necessarily suggest we've been less rigorous. I don't want to be obsessed with that figure, but it was important, I think, as an indicator that we were taking things a bit more seriously. And we also need to focus that the greatest number of complaints will always go and should always go to the publishers themselves. And so their internal standard system and their internal complaint systems are a crucial part of the whole picture. In many ways, our main goal should be to influence the internal standards and the internal complaints processes. It's understandable that journalists will always go first to their internal systems. And if they can work effectively, that's great. So we're going to engage much more with that. We're seeking access to regular statistics as to the type of complaints being dealt with and the outcomes of them. And I think we'll be proposing some benchmarks for a good complaint system, which will often consist of looking at best practice in different parts of the media already. And we need to make our standards more readily available. I've already spoken with Phil Gardner, for example, from the Herald Sun here, and with other editors about ways in which our standards can be put on the intranet or whatever other internal information system there is, so that there's a one-click stop, as it were, to see the standards of the newspaper and the standards of the council. That's a very important practical thing if we want journalists to go down the right path. We're going to have to look a lot at online standards. That's going to be a key focus over the next few years, looking at the extent to which comment streams should be moderated, in other words, sifted and selected before the material is put on the stream. Not necessarily saying it should. There are various other methods that are being tried. It's a very fluid area, but we need to look at that. We need to look at the issue of what's often called reputation management, where a lot of people are very concerned that information has been put. It may be that 15 years ago they did something regrettable. It now comes out on the top when you Google their name in the search engine, even though, for example, if spent convictions legislation applies, that period will pass. The spent convictions legislation now is a waste of paper because your conviction will probably come up in the Google. So we need to look at that. That's the thing that's worrying online editors. They've actually asked us, when we had a meeting of online editors, they asked us to help them develop rules. And we'll also do impact monitoring. By that I mean that there's no point setting standards if we don't look at whether those standards are being complied with, not just rely on the complaint system. That's well known to be an inadequate way of assessing whether your standards are being complied with. And apart from anything else, assessing whether the standards are wrong, whether they need to be modified. I mean, if the standards are not being complied with, one has to look at least as much as whether they're wrong as whether, they're right but not being complied with. So we will do impact monitoring if we can get the resources to do it. That's a key point. And I finish by saying that we will also look at policy issues, but in the past the council has tended too often, I think, to see itself as an advocate for the industry. That's quite misconceived, and it creates a clear conflict of interest to be an advocate for the industry, just saying this is what the industry wants, therefore we will push it in a debate on freedom of speech or whatever. Clear conflict with our role as a neutral a mediator and arbiter, as it were, in complaints. That was a point that Mr. Finkelstein was concerned about. He put to me that we shouldn't do any policy work for that reason. I don't agree with that. What was the mistake was to do policy work where we see ourselves as an advocate for the industry. Our role is to be concerned about the public interest, the broader public interest. A very important part of that will be the interest of the industry, because that's very important in the public interest, but it's not the dominant. And finally, just as to where we go in phase two, after a few years or whatever it may be, when we move towards convergence, as I've mentioned, we favour an independent council there rather than a statutory authority. I emphasise that in moving towards convergence, and in a sense all regulation being under one roof, doesn't mean the regulation needs to be totally uniform. There's clear opportunities and justifications for having differences in processes, differences to some extent in standards, or certainly in the practical application of standards in particular areas. But we do need this all under one roof, so that where there's a huge risk of inconsistency or confusion, where particular material has occurred in different media, we need to get a harmonised, consistent approach to it if we're looking at a particular complaint or whatever. And that's one of the reasons why we need to come together under one roof. But we don't want the body to be legalistic. We don't want it to be slow. We don't want it to be government appointed. We also, of course, don't want it to be publisher dominated. But it's a crucial element is there needs to be a very strong engagement with publishers, actively providing leadership within the council and in a non-adversarial way. Well, I just finished by saying that what I emphasised on the way through, that this is a huge challenge, but I believe that this is the sort of best hope for trying to move from where we are to where we should be. I think it's a pity that some of the publishers in effect gave Mr. Finkelstein no option but to go for another option than the Press Council, because they said they wouldn't provide any more resources. Now, I'm hopeful that attitude is changing. We're having negotiations right now to see if there will be a willingness to provide the significant improvement in resources we need. But I think it was a pity that, in effect, Mr. Finkelstein was deprived of being able to go down that route. We want to go down that route, and we want to achieve the substantial, demonstrable improvement in the next 3 years that I've mentioned. Thank you.
you very much, Julian. Now, Julian has agreed to take some questions, and we'll move to that in just a moment. But first, a message from your sponsor. That's the Centre for Advanced Journalism. We have a programme of events. Please feel free to go to our website and click on the appropriate links to get on our mailing list. But in particular, to tonight's topic, we have this upcoming short course. There's flyers for it out the front there, which is aimed at working journalists and newsroom executives. And in being a one-stop shop on a one-day short course on what Press Council standards actually are and what appropriate newsroom procedures are for handling public complaints, given, as Julian said, the very important, continually important, frontline role of the publishers themselves in handling complaints. The other short course we're offering, also in April, is not directly relevant tonight, but it's one I'm very proud to be overseeing. It's in advanced non-fiction writing with Helen Garner and Michael Gawenda, running an intensive over two weekends for advanced non-fiction writers. Again, the flyers are available out the front, so please feel free to pick them up. But anyway, we have some time for some questions. I'm going to chair here. Please do make it questions, not statements or speeches. There'll be other times for that, doubtless, and I'll ask Julian to respond. The lady there in the brown top, and then up the back. Can you just wait till the microphone reaches you, please? Yeah. Okay, the question, I think, was, for those who didn't hear it, how can we be confident that the council won't be publisher-dominated if it is publisher-funded? Is that a fair summary? Yeah.
Well, that is the major challenge. It's not only a challenge in practice, but it's a challenge in perception. The greatest worry that people have about the council, and it's a perfectly understandable worry, is that we're fully funded by the publishers. It's the counterpart of the publishers' worries if we were fully funded by the government. It's a fundamental problem, but it's a problem that we can try to reduce in a few ways. Firstly, as I said, if we can get security of publisher funding so that we're not at the mercy of it being withdrawn, that reduces the problem to some extent. If we can also supplement it, as we have been authorised to do in the past, so I got agreement from the council 18 months or so ago for some project funding to come from other sources. We have some funding from the Meyer Foundation now. I would like to develop that in the project area. And that's partly because, in many ways, I mean, I've spent much of my life, really, in organisations where we deliberately got funding from a wide range of sources. That's the best way, actually, of achieving independence, is diversity. You're very consciously, if you, for example, in the housing area where I was chairing a business and community coalition, you get some funding from the housing industry, but you get some funding and other support from shelter and groups like that that represent the tenants. And that way, you can achieve an independence through the balance of your funding. Now, we may be able to go in that direction to some extent with the council through project funding. It's going to be a tougher call in relation to core funding as to whether that can be changed in any way. But I think that at least for the foreseeable future, if we get the security of publisher funding, that does significantly reduce the problem. I should mention too that actually our council, only a third of our council are actually publisher representatives. That's not widely known. So in that sense, it's not dominated by the publishers. But of course, the power of the purse is important. But the other thing I'd say is that I think one can overcome some of those problems by performance. And that's one reason why, if we've got enough resources to show that we are independent, to show that we're not under the thumb, then that can help to ameliorate that problem as well. I don't pretend it's not a problem, but you have to look at the problems with other options as well. And what I'm keen on doing is trying to ameliorate both the reality and the perception of that problem.
Okay, the question was, could Julian elaborate on the contractual and binding nature of the obligations that are currently in place?
Well, what we have in mind, we're working it through now, what we have in mind is that if you link the obligations to the Constitution, if you make them either in the Constitution or next to the Constitution, there you can create a contractual relationship with those who've joined the Council. My counterpart in the UK has actually drafted a detailed contract that he's wanting to get the industry to comply with there. I don't think we'll go that route. I'm not quite sure what you've got in the contract. It isn't available now, but we'll be mainly wanting to just get publishers by joining the council. That means they agree to comply with the Constitution plus annexure. We already have a one-page summary of obligations and on the back of it a one-page explanation of what that means in relation to publication of adjudications. There would be a few more obligations we would add to that, but it's that sort of order of things. And the obligations include funding obligations, which I hope will be very specific. That's what a lot of the negotiations are about now. Obligations which admittedly are somewhat vague, but obligations to cooperate with our investigations and obligations to publish our adjudications and some detail about how that has to be done. But if they're contractually binding, they're then enforceable.
The question was, is the Council concerned with media ownership and the way in which ownership issues might be reflected in coverage of particular issues?
Yeah, well, some aspects of ownership are relevant to us in that, of course, declaring conflicts of interest is important. How frequently you need have to declare, for example, when News Limited, you know, owns rugby league teams, do they need to mention that all the time, or are there ways in which we can put people on notice of that who don't know, but not be endlessly repeating the same thing every time? So there are some issues that can arise there, and obviously some of those problems are aggravated if we have an increasing tendency for either for media companies to undertake non-media activities or for non-media organisations to invest in media companies. I mean, that's been discussed a lot, and that is relevant to us in the sort of medium or micro level of whether they declare conflicts of interest in particular cases. Another aspect in which it's relevant is that that's another reason why we're so keen to encourage quality online publishing to get the get greater attention, broader credibility, and help in some way. That in turn can provide greater diversity. If you look at the Finkelstein report, for example, I think basically the reporting of that in the print media was lamentable. The reporting of it in the online media was infinitely better. But that reporting, and I mean just by that saying what's in it. Now, of course, that's partly taking advantage of online's ability to have more, you know, more copy. That's one of the great benefits that it can bring. But that's only of limited value if that stuff's only being read by a very small number of aficionados or people who probably need to get a life and, you know, do other things. I couldn't help when I saw these five or six, I thought, really good articles, not necessarily ones I agreed with, but thoughtful, detailed articles. I thought this is a real pity that this isn't getting out into the mainstream print media as well, and there's no easy to answer this, and our role in this is fairly small, but it's relevant to the question of ownership and lack of diversity.
Okay, the question was, does a system of regulation unfairly favour outlets such as the ABC and broadsheet newspapers over outlets such as tabloid newspapers, which are still very popular and which display some of the desirable qualities of aggression? Is that a fair summary?
Yeah. Well, of course, it all depends how you do the regulation, whether you are too harsh or whether you take account of, firstly, whether your general application of standards, irrespective of what publication it's in, whether that's appropriate, but also whether you take account of your readership when you're forming a judgment. I don't think we have a very clear view. I don't think we would take the view in the council that there's a particular aspect of the print media that's the biggest problem. I wouldn't see a huge divide between tabloids and broadsheet in that respect. That's ceasing to be a terribly useful description anyway. But we do need to... you also need to be careful in assuming that people want what they're reading. And so be very careful in a limited market about assuming that the people who are reading the newspaper, I'm not saying this particularly about tabloids, I'd say it about radio and other things. You need to be careful of assuming that those people actually particularly like what they're getting. And that's why these opinion polls are relevant as well. You know, it's a bit glib for some to say, well, if people didn't like us, they wouldn't buy us. There aren't too many options. And so we need to be careful of giving that too much weight. But I read the tabloids as much as, well, we're talking here really about the Telly and the Herald Sun. I read them about as much as the broadsheets. There's some very good stuff there, which often benefits from being succinct, frankly.
Okay, the question was, the ABC and the SBS are independent bodies despite being dependent on government funding, and there's confusion about why government funding necessarily means a reduction in independence, and could the council follow a model similar to that?
Well, there are different views about that within the council, as I mentioned. So some people regard any government funding as anathema and think it's impossible to be funded by government, although often I do wish there would be a greater sophistication in that discussion, because it often speaks as if government funding means full government funding, just as it often speaks as if any statutory involvement means a statutory authority. Now, in the UK, for the reasons I mentioned, they've been pushed perhaps into a more sophisticated analysis and realising there's a whole spectrum of options in terms of statutory involvement which can fall very far short of a statutory authority. The same applies to government funding. As I say, the council's already agreed that we can take some project funding, but I actually initiated, when that motion was put forward, I actually initiated the fact that we should have a ceiling on that. And a ceiling well below 50%, and that's just for project funding. So some government funding, I think, can be acceptable, but there's also, again, here we've got perception and reality. So one of the reasons why I don't like full or dominant government funding is that it would cast a spectre of suspicion over what that agency did, even if it wasn't being pushed around by government at all. It's the counterpart of the problem with full publisher funding. So, in an ideal or even remotely ideal world, I would prefer that this regulatory body is overwhelmingly funded by non-government sources, if we can do that.
Okay. Right, well, that's it, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for your attendance, and thanks most of all to Professor Julian Disney. Please join me in thanking him again.